This is Scott Hawk. I'm interviewing Craig Misichet at the Veterans Office at the University of Montana in Missoula, Montana. So, and I'm going to invade your personal space. I'll be like right up in you.
Okay.
Let's go ahead by giving me your name, where you're from.
Okay.
And when you served.
Okay.
And where you served.
Okay. My name is Craig Raymond Misichet. I was born in Paterson, New Jersey, but moved out west when I was like 3 years old. So we originally moved to Clark, Wyoming, then we moved to Dillon, Montana. Then I ended up growing up for the majority of my childhood in Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is where my parents still live today. I graduated high school one semester early because I was not the best student, I would say. I was getting into a lot of trouble, so I really needed to get out of there. And I joined the Marine Corps, so I left for boot camp in February of 2008. And I served in the Marine Corps. I signed a 5-year contract and ended up getting, we called it the 90-day early out, but it was basically 3 months cut off the end of your contract if you weren't engaged in any specific duty that you had to fulfill before your EAS date, which is your end of active service. So instead of going all the way to February 2013, I got out in November of 2012 and then started school in January 2013 at University of Montana.
So tell me about your family. Tell me about your parents. What do they do?
My dad, he was a jeweler. He's retired now. My great-grandfather was a watchmaker and repairman who came here from Poland. And then his son became a jeweler in New York. And then my dad went to school for the same thing. And he did that when we moved out here. He opened his own store in Cody, Wyoming, 5 Bar M Jewelry Company. He ran that for about 17 years as the sole proprietor, worker, and owner. And then my mother went to nursing school back east in Massachusetts. She's originally from upstate New York. And she was a nurse for right around 18 years, just shy of 20 probably. And then she went back to school and got a master's degree and moved into the administration side of healthcare.
Any brothers or sisters?
Yeah. I have a brother. His name is Ken. He went to school in Oklahoma, and he got an international business degree with a Russian minor, but couldn't find a job. He graduated in 2009, right after the economy started to go down a little bit. So he ended up getting a job at a hospital doing sterile processing, and then moved around a bunch, found a bunch of different people that wanted to work for. So he kind of went from Oakland, California, to New York City, to Dallas, and then now he's back in Sacramento working at sterile processing, sort of on the administrative side now. He's moved up in that since he did have a college degree. He's able to move up a little bit faster. So, and then I also have a sister. Her name's Heather. She wanted to go to school for fashion something, but it wasn't exactly a feasible option. So I think she ended up getting a general business degree. And then now she's working on a couple entrepreneurial ideas of her own, but she lives out in California as well now, kind of working odd jobs. And she was in California. Now she moves around a lot. So now she lives down in Phoenix and she works for a travel agency, which is right up her alley. She really enjoys traveling. So working for a travel agency, she gets a lot of discounts and kind of the scoop on the best places to go.
So what were you doing before you entered the service?
Just school. I was, like I said, I wasn't a terrible student per se, but I liked working a lot more because I liked having money, and going to school didn't get me money. So I got a job at Outback Steakhouse and at the municipal pool as a lifeguard, and just kind of worked two jobs and was more interested in making money and hanging out with friends than really doing anything related to school. I knew pretty early on that I wasn't going to go to college, and then wanted to be a pilot in my younger days, but I realized that wasn't really a feasible option for me. My eyesight was terrible, and my grades weren't also that great either. So I decided to join the Marines. Like I said, I graduated a semester early. I went to the BYU. They offer online high school courses, so non-collegiate level courses that people can take. So I took those while at the same time taking the first semester of what was my senior year. Finished all of that at the midpoint, and that allowed me to join. So before that, really, I was just living at home. Joined when I was 17, so I never really had a job after I was considered an adult legally, except for the Marine Corps until I moved here and started school.
So tell me about why you decided to join the Marine Corps. Why did you join the service? Why the Marines? What was your thinking back then?
I don't know. You always do a lot of looking back and kind of justifying it and finding good reasons. But I think a lot of it is from being from Cheyenne, Wyoming. There isn't a whole lot going on. And it's a place where a lot of people get into trouble. A lot of people that I went to school with did. And I knew that I didn't want to do that. And my family has a pretty long tradition of military service and things like that. So I knew I wanted to join. And then just talking to the Marines, it seemed that I didn't want to join the military to be in supply or logistics or anything like that. I wanted to join the military to go to war. And I know I'm a big history buff, so I kind of think that young men, usually it's a pretty common calling throughout history for them to want to go and fight in a war. So I knew that the one place that I could be guaranteed that was in the Marines if I joined and did infantry, because I was always told that the Marines, you know, they're the toughest, they're the best, they're the hardest branch to get through. And I think that kind of informed me a lot. So
tell me about your family history serving.
Okay. I told you about my grandfather. He came over from Poland in 1917. He was, the family story goes, it could be an untruth, but it's a fun story to tell. At the time, most of Poland was part of the Russian Empire, and it was during the what would later become the Bolshevik Revolution, but the Russian Revolution of 1917. And they came around to all local farms and impressed young men into service, basically having them fight for them. So the story goes, he hid in a hay bale when they came to his father's farm. And then after they left, he somehow made his way out of Europe and came to the United States. So in 1917, he got here, and they said, well, what skills do you have? And he says, well, I'm a watchmaker. And they said, perfect. So they put him in a factory making bombs, the small little parts that would go into the primitive bombs at the time. But as a watchmaker, he had a pretty unique knowledge of those kind of things. So they put him in a factory working there. After that, he went back. After the war ended, he went back to Poland. Then came back. He met my great-grandmother here. And they had, I believe, 11 children. And there were 5 boys. And 4 of them served in World War II. I forget his name right now. I think it was Uncle Joey. He was actually at D-Day. He was at Normandy. And he got machine gun across the knees. So a couple of them were in Italy. And then the North African campaign. The only son that didn't serve in World War II was my grandfather. He was the youngest, so he missed the cutoff. But he enlisted as soon as he could. It was right before the war ended. Then it ended, and he ended up getting stationed in Germany after the war as sort of the powers kind of broke Berlin up into different areas. So he actually has the coin of him being in Berlin when all the nations were there, and kind of the fallout from the war and peace talks and all that stuff. But he stayed into Korea. And then another one of his brothers, Uncle Benny, actually went to Korea. He was in World War II and Korea. And then my dad was only 5 when Vietnam started, so he never joined the service. But on my mother's side, my grandfather on my mother's side was a pilot in the Army Air Corps in the Pacific during World War II. And he flew something like 70 combat missions in the Pacific. And so he got a job offer after he came back to fly commercial airlines. And he refused it because at the time he could make more money being a crane operator for high-rise construction. So he did that for the rest of his life and kind of missed out on the boom from air travel. But his son, my uncle, he joined the Army, and he's actually still in now. He took a... After he was in for 22 years, he took a break, then went back. But I think he's been in for about 25 years now. And he was in the Army for a lot of the smaller conflicts, I guess, throughout the 80s and 90s. And then the early 2000s, he went back after the War on Terror started to kind of work in an administrative role.
Do you think that your family history had any influence or any sway in your decision to join?
I would say it had an influence in joining, yes, but the Marine Corps, no. I think, to my knowledge, I'm the only one that ever joined the Marine Corps out of my family. It was mostly Army. So I would say it did, definitely, though, as kind of a tradition of service there. So,
What was your folks' reaction whenever you told them that you had enlisted?
I didn't get to tell them I enlisted. I had to ask their permission, basically, because they had to sign off because I was 17. But my old man was pretty happy about it. I'm all happy, but he knew that the college route right after high school wasn't exactly for me. He kind of recognized that. So he was pretty supportive of it. And then my mom was, she wanted me to go to college so I can be an officer, which wasn't what I wanted to do. So they were supportive of the general decision, but maybe not of the route I took. I think they would have rather me go and then be an officer, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. So
let's go back to the day that that you got on the bus and headed out. Tell me about that experience, what it was like.
Okay, so the MEP station, military entry processing, something like that. There isn't one in Cheyenne, Wyoming, because it's so small. So we had to drive to Denver. So they dropped me off, and my mom started crying. And then my dad asked her if there was something wrong with her eyes. And then the recruiter drove me down there, drove me to Denver. Basically went in the next day and did the in-processing and then flew to they took us to the Denver airport. And I think it was in Cheyenne that day, it was like negative 40 degrees. So I remember it being bitterly cold because it was in February. And then DIA almost closed when we were supposed to fly out. So we were all freaking out, like, we're supposed to be in boot camp and we're going to miss it and all this stuff. But they ended up flying us out. We flew into L.A., which was kind of a cool experience. We drove everywhere as a kid, so I'd never really seen a big city, but not important. We flew into L.A., and then we got on to, and at that point, you kind of realize the other young men with short haircuts and in relatively good shape, they're all kind of sitting there minding their own business with no family or anything, and you're like, well, I guess you're going the same place I am. So there was probably about 10 or 15 of us, and we got on this little single-engine plane. It flew us from L.A. to San Diego. We landed in San Diego, which is the airport in San Diego is literally, there's a fence that separates it from MCRD, the Marine Corps Recruit Depot. So, yeah, we got off there and then waited, got on the bus. And it's just like in the movies that they come out with, you know, they make you like put your head between your legs, you're sitting there and then you don't know where you're going. They drive around to confuse you and all that, but it's really, they drive around for like half an hour, but it's a 5-minute drive from the airport to the depot. It's just they right off the bat they start trying to mess with you mentally. But yeah, we got there and then the guy got on the bus and you just hear this guy in like really gravelly voice like start yelling at you, you know, and then he's like, when I say to get off my bus, you'll get off my bus. And then, you know, you go in there and they cut your hair and they're yelling at you and screaming at you, and then you stay up for like 40 hours straight. So it gets a little fuzzy after that, but it's pretty much they want to weed everybody out as fast as they can. So that first initial part is just 48 hours, no sleep. You go into this little holding barracks thing, and then whichever platoon or company is picking up at that point, like 3 days after that or a week after that, I forget exactly how long, you'll go to your actual platoon, and that's when you meet the drill instructors, and it goes from there.
Was it what you expected it to be, what you thought or envisioned it would be like?
It was kind of weird for me. I mean, I've always told people this, and they don't necessarily believe me, but I think my old man probably yelled at me louder than any drill instructor ever had. So, I mean, it definitely wasn't easy by any means, but I think the hardest part of boot camp was the mental factor. The physical factor was there, and you did have to be a strong person to get through it, but mentally was the biggest challenge. And for me, we always came up with little things. I had this, my buddy Hauk, he ended up going to be what we call a pogue, a person other than a grunt, but at the time, you know, you're all boots, so it doesn't matter. But, we always had to clean the bathroom. So it was one of those things where you kind of learn to take pride in anything you do, but I had to clean the toilets, which is not a very glamorous job, but it's like those toilets were probably the cleanest toilets on that base, just because you had to take pride in it. And if you didn't, you would get hazed basically. But when we were doing it, we used to sing like Eazy-E and just other rap songs that we both knew, you know, completely different parts of the country, completely different families, but just kind of those common things that you know. So you'd find the commonalities between people and then use that just to get through it, you know, like make light of the situation. And then they would catch you singing and, you know, you'd have to go do 5,000 push-ups or whatever dumb stuff they wanted you to do that day. It was like, it was kind of worth it, though. And then at night you'd have fire watch, so you would fire watch is just watching the squad bay because the other drill instructors will try and come in and steal stuff so they can mess with each other. You know, they have to make light of it too because their job is very, very hard. I mean, they spend 90 hours a week with you, and they're away from their families and all that. But we would go around, and the guys would be awake, and we always had the guys that were good at impersonations. So I ended up being one of those. For some reason, just the two drill instructors we had, that I did like the perfect impersonation of them. So, you know, we just made light of the situation any way you could.
So during boot camp, what was your worst day? Let's start with the worst day before we get to best day. What was your worst day in boot camp?
Gosh, I mean, I don't even think I have a worst day. I think the whole time before you go to the rifle range, so phase one, was probably the worst day. But I can't really single one out as being like, that was the worst day, because they were all pretty equally bad. So, I mean, I can't think of one day where it just sticks out in my mind like, that really sucked. There was one time this is just a common thing. It wasn't just one day, but that we got spaghetti for dinner. And then there was the one they call them fat kids, but they're on half rats. They only get half as much food as the other people because they want them to lose weight and get in standards and all that. But they caught him. He was eating a cookie at dinner, so they took us out for PT after dinner, and we vomited everywhere. And then we went back and we had to dump foot lockers, which is also a common occurrence, but they found peanut butter packets, which is the dumbest thing. But for some reason, people just stole peanut butter packets and put them like in their pockets and brought them back. You weren't allowed to do that. There was no food in the squad bay. But like I said, these were pretty common, so that would happen probably once a week. And then it was just a constant haze fest after that.
Tell me what hazing is, what it was in boot camp.
Yeah, we're not supposed to call it hazing, because hazing implies that there's someone in a position of authority that's abusing it. But in boot camp, it's constructive, how do they word it? It's like constructive activities, basically. So if you're not doing what you're told, and you're not figuring out what they want you to do and doing it as fast as possible, which is never fast enough, then we just call it hazing, but it doesn't have a negative connotation. In boot camp, that's what they do. That's from the movies. It's what you see. It's just these activities that you realize looking back. It's like, that's what broke you down and made you more into a cohesive unit. So it's just a word that everyone understands. If I said constructive activities, like, well, what did you guys do? But everyone kind of understands the word hazing. You're like, that's pretty much what it was. But at the same time, it had a purpose. It had a use. And it was fundamental in actually turning you into a Marine.
What was the hardest constructive, whatever you called it, that you went through during boot camp?
Oh, there was so many. I think one of the worst ones, and I don't know why it sticks out like this, but we had, it's called mattresses in the rain room. And you take the rain room is what they call a shower. There's stupid little sayings for everything. We took our mattresses out and stacked them in the shower room. Then they turned the water on, and I don't know. That was just a really stupid one. There was no reason behind it. That's why it stuck out, because normally it was, you know, stuff that like was really physically demanding. So, but then throwing your mattress in the shower, that was always just a dumb one. So we never really, that's what pissed us off, because there was no purpose behind it. But I think one of the worst ones that just sticks out is we had, what did they call it? They called it like left side, right side, or something like that. There's bunk beds, and there's two guys always standing right in front of them. And they would say left side or right side. And if they said left side, you had to turn left, run in a circle all the way around as they counted down from 10, which they can do faster than any human being on the planet. And you're never fast enough, so they make you do it again. And I don't know why this sticks out to me, but the one time we must have done it like 150 times, just running sprints around this. And then they would do left, 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 and then right. And then somebody would go left, and they'd be like, all right. So just dumb repetitive stuff like that sticks out to you. Like, yeah, you were getting exercise, and that's kind of important, but it was really just killing time. We probably had something to do like 2 hours from then. Like, just mess with them for a little while. But
so tell me about the bonds, the friends that you made during boot camp.
The best example I have is my friend Lauren Jolly. He's from New Mexico, and he I don't know if he wants me to tell him his name, but we'll figure it out. He got a degree in civil engineering at the University of New Mexico years before, and he was working in Albuquerque as an engineer, making quite a decent amount of money for anyone, really. It was working as an engineer. So after a while, I guess he just decided in 2008 that he wanted to be a Marine. He wanted to do his thing. So he lied to the recruiters so he could be enlisted because he didn't want to be an officer. They'll make you go officer if they know you have a college degree. So he was in my same platoon in boot camp. And he was always kind of more of a mature person. I guess I always hung out with people that were a little bit older anyway. So we formed a bond there. And then since he was infantry as well, we ended up going to SOI together. We're in the same platoon. And then in SOI, there were, from what they told us, we dropped more people than any other battalion ever. I think we started with 150 and graduated 86. But it was a relatively rough phase. And then we were kind of two of the people left. And out of those 86, I think there was 15 or 20 that got sent to 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, which is a terrible, terrible place to be. Everyone else got sent to Hawaii for 3rd Marines. But just so happened that the way it broke down, they just did it randomly alphabetically. Me and this guy Jolly got sent to the same spot. So we actually ended up being in the same platoon the entire duration of my Marine Corps career. So just one of those people that, you know, we still talk to each other, we'll text or whatever, pretty much every day, and we haven't seen each other in, he got out in 2011, so we haven't seen each other in 3 years now, but still talk pretty much every day, and just, you know, that's what I would say is the best example, but there are other friends like that, too, that I'll still talk to on a pretty regular basis.
Did you adapt to military life fairly easily, or was it difficult?
I think for me it was really easy, actually. Just being 17 and not really having, I went in, like I said, I graduated a semester early, so I didn't go in with a lot of other peers that were my age. A lot of the guys were older and more mature, and I think for me it was just really easy falling into that. The older guys had a problem with it because they'd been doing their own thing for a while, you know, and being told what to do and when to do it, and they always had a gripe and, you know, bitch and complain about it. But for me, just like, it was really simple. It's just really simple lifestyle. You know, you have a job. If you do it when you're told and how you're told, then life is good. I mean, there's not really, it's not a complicated lifestyle. You're not performing brain surgery or anything like that. You just do what you're told when you're told to do it. Learn your job. Do it well. Take care of yourself and the guys that are with you. And that's really all there is to it. I mean, there are some things that, you know, you'll miss things, you'll miss holidays, you won't see your family for a long time. But I think for me, I liked it because I wanted to get out in the world. I wanted to see things, kind of write my own story, so to speak. So I enjoyed it, actually.
So after graduation from boot camp, mm-hmm. When did you first learn where you were going to be and what you were going to be doing, where you're going to be deployed and whatnot?
Okay, so when I signed the contract, I signed as 03XX, so that's just infantry open going into SOI, the School of Infantry, sorry. So after that, I knew that I was going to be going to SOI, but I didn't know exactly what my job would be. You don't really find that out unless you sign a recon contract or something like that, which I hadn't done. So once I got to SOI, thought we were going to get picked up. But the day I got there, they have something called Camp Guard, which is guys that come in that aren't going to get picked up right away. They stand guard at everyone else's armories. It's 12-hour post, 12 on, 12 off. We did that for 6 weeks before we got picked up because the battalion that was picking up when we got there was full, and that was Delta Company, colloquially known as Do Nothing Delta and SOI West. And then the next battalion picking up was Alpha Company, which is also known as Alpha Traz or Alcatraz Alpha. Basically the complete opposite end of you could have had it like this and now you have a shitty situation. So as soon as I got there, went through SOI, you go through, I think it's 4 weeks, and then they have what's called the split. And the split is, if you're going to be an 11, which I was, that's your rifleman, basic infantryman, and that's an 03-11. If not, then you can go be an 03-31, which is a machine gunner, a 41, which is a mortarman, or a 51, which is a 51 is a, they call them assault men. They play with C4 and all that fun stuff. And then 52s are tow gunners. So all those guys get specialized training and go off to learn their field, and then we focus more on just the basic infantry skills and more rifleman stuff, just things along that nature, or just being a normal squad. You don't have a specialized weapon system or anything that you have to learn. So the 11s constitute the majority of the infantry population. There's just more of them than everyone else because the other ones are, usually like a machine gunner or something like that will be a squad or a platoon asset, whereas the platoons are made up of 11s. So at the very end of SOI, when I finally found out where I was going, that story I was telling you about when everyone went to Hawaii, they just got us all together. They called out these 15 names, and they said, you guys are going to Camp Lejeune. And the guy, one of the guys, the instructors have been stationed there, and he just came in and gave us the down and dirty about how terrible of a place it was. And then he's like, and everyone else is going to 3rd Marines, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines in Hawaii, which I've heard has its downside too, but I don't know. Having been to Lejeune and never having been to Hawaii, I think that I can confidently say, even not having been there, that Hawaii would have been a much better place to be.
Bad. Yeah. It sounds giant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lejeune is, it's literally built on a swamp. So.
I've heard it. I've heard about it before. So so
tell me about the day that you got word that you were going to be deployed. What was that like?
The first time was, actually, this is a pretty much enlistment-long phenomena, but the first time they kept telling us we were going to get deployed, just too many times to count. They would always come up with new dates and stuff, so we never really knew until probably about 3 months before we went. So this would have been summer, probably springtime of 2009, and they told us to go to Iraq. We said, okay, cool. So then haze, and that's what you view the world through when you looked outside. It's just this disgusting place. But that sucked. Kuwait really sucked. But after that, we flew into where was it now? We flew into Al Asad Air Base in Iraq, which was one of the, I think it is the, was the biggest base, if not one of the biggest in the country. So that was where like the Olympic team the Iraqi Olympic team. I think it was a soccer team. They had them all killed in that stadium because they didn't, you know, win and all that. That was all there. But we flew in. I remember it was disgustingly hot, and it just smelled awful. It was just, I mean, Iraq as a country in general, the parts that I've experienced smell awful because it's just a dirty place, I guess. But I guess the best way to describe the smells would be actually not in Al-Asad, but a little bit to the south. There's a Iraqi town called Hit, H-I-T, and they had a city-sized open sewer. And this was in September, like early September, so just coming out of summer. And that was, I can't describe it to you, but that is like a three square acre just open cesspool with the sun baking it constantly all day. And that kind of gives you a hint at some of the smells that you had in Iraq. I mean, it was kind of cool. We were right on, you would drive down the road that was right next to the Euphrates River, you know. If you grew up going to church or anything, or had read a bunch of history books or, you know, take in world history, you'd heard about the Euphrates and the Tigris, you know, and the Fertile Crescent and all these, you know, ancient places, the seat of civilization, and then you're driving past it and there's just piles of human shit everywhere and it smells awful. And trees only grow for about a mile, maybe not even that, on the side of the river, and then it's just desert. So, like, well, I mean, good on them for being able to do it, but it was just... It was kind of a unique view, I guess, just seeing these ancient places and, I don't know, not really being impressed by them. Something that you think, like, if I go see the pyramids or something like that, it's going to be awesome. Then you see something like that that has such a storied history, and it's just a dirty, nasty place, and the reality kind of set in. You're like, well, you can travel the world, but it may not be always what it's cracked up to be.
So you get settled in at base. Tell me about... going out and experiencing your first time in combat. You're fighting the Taliban at this time, is that correct?
I would have been Al-Qaeda still in Iraq, but in Iraq I never got a combat action ribbon. I never saw combat in Iraq. We drove a lot of convoys, we saw a lot of IEDs, but we never got what's called a troops in contact or a TIC. It was a lot of boring, long days. Driving the company command around. This was in 2009, so Iraq was... We were actually the last Marine battalion strength element in Iraq. We got relieved by the 82nd Airborne when we left. So there were really no more Marines there after us, and there wasn't a whole lot going on. It was after the surge had been largely successful, and for the most part, the biggest threat that we had was RKG-3s. They're a handheld grenade, but they have an EFP in them. An EFP is an explosively formed projectile, and it's a little brass or copper plate that's convex. And when you throw it at something, the explosion, it has a little parachute that comes out the back. So they would throw it at our trucks and Humvees and the MRAPs. They would throw them at the MRAPs because the MRAPs were kind of our answer to RPGs. You know, they're mine-resistant, ambush-protected. They're really heavily armored. But these were Russian-designed things, and they would throw them just like you would, I guess, like a Nerf football, you know, the one that has a little tail on the end. Parachute would come out to steady it. As soon as it hit something, the explosive would go off, and then the EFP inside of it would basically be turned into a slug, and it would go through MRAP armor like butter. So that was our biggest threat. But none of the convoys I was on in Iraq ever got hit by those. There was a guy in Fallujah that got hit by one while we were there, I think from an army convoy. But yeah, for Iraq, the combat was just minimal. A lot of it was just driving around avoiding IEDs.
So what was your day-to-day experiences during this time? I mean, what were you guys doing?
Well, it would be usually, if you had a convoy, wake up at like 4, go pre-check your truck, make sure everything was good with that. We had a shortage of drivers in the battalion, so they made 11s do it to drive around our own guys, and I was one of the unlucky ones that got stuck with that. I guess I was smart enough to actually pass all the tests and stuff, or maybe not smart, because the really smart guys would have failed them, so they didn't have to drive. But basically, you'd wake up at 4, you'd go make sure your truck was good, you'd get everything ready, you'd stock it with water, chow, ammo, all that, and then you'd go out for, you know, 9 or 10 hours, whatever, how long it was, and then you come back, you would clean up your truck, refuel it, make sure everything was ready to go, do that, you'd get back at like 9, maybe, and then... Yeah, usually after that, it was if you had another one the next day. Like, there was a shortage of drivers, so it was the same guys drove for every platoon, regardless of... Normally, every platoon would have their own drivers, but a limited amount. And then me and three other guys actually had the... we had the holy grail of licenses, which was 7-ton licenses, and they're big troop carriers. But there was only 4 guys in the entire company that had one, so pretty much every day I was just out driving, doing that same routine.
So you ended up seeing a lot then. You were doing a lot of driving, right? So you got to see a lot of the country and see a lot of the guys and what they were doing. And
yeah. Yeah, we did quite a bit. Yeah, pretty much what you said. I mean, we drove around a lot all the time, got to see the locals fairly often. You got to recognize one guy that was always sitting out in front of his shop smoking every single time we drove past. So they call it establishing a baseline. You just kind of get used to seeing things. You're like, well, that guy's there. Everything's normal. Nothing to worry about. Yeah, I mean, there's not really a whole lot I can say about Iraq. It was just a lot of monotonous, you know, repetitive stuff.
Did you interact with the locals at all? What was that like?
Usually I didn't. I did on a couple occasions, just like if you went down to like a bazaar or something and someone was selling things, then you can interact with the locals then, and you're buying from them, doing that kind of thing. But since I was a driver, there's the combat rules that you always stay in the truck if you're the driver, so you have to be ready to go. So usually I just sat there inside the truck and waited. But
it sounds like it's kind of boring. I hate to be so blunt, but it does. It sounds like you're driving around every day. You're driving guys around doing, you know, odd things, and then you're having to sit in your truck, you know, all day long, and then going back to base and then doing it again, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, it was really, really boring. You said it exactly. That's all we did. I mean, there wasn't really a whole lot going on. There wasn't any big events. I mean, I think... One of the big ones was, like, one moment of excitement that could have happened was System of a Down was going to come play a concert there. So it tells you how much of a combat zone it was. But then at the last minute, they, like, canceled. So, and then there was one kid we always made fun of. He was a character. But when he got there, he stayed at Al-Asad and with, like, the battalion element. And he took up salsa dancing because there were salsa lessons. And that was, like, his way to break it up. It was, like, some people had time for that shit. I didn't, but, yeah, it was really just a lot of boredom, just finding things to occupy your time. I think that that's a pretty common theme through any deployment, even a deployment that's heavy with contact or combat, so to speak. The majority of your time isn't spent, you know, in combat. It's spent sitting on post or, you know, doing busy work, so.
So you get done in Iraq, and you guys come back stateside, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got done in Iraq. Like I said, we got relieved by the 82nd. Got back, and...
Did you just stay on base? Did you get to go home at all?
Yeah, you have a post-deployment leave, so I went and did that. I mean, I don't have any heartfelt stories of, like, my family greeting me or anything. It's just I always told them not to come because it was a big waste of time. I was going to get, you know, 2 weeks off or whatever after I deployed anyway. So, yeah. I just got back and then kind of fell back into the rhythm of doing everything. We got stuck in these really shitty overflow barracks that had, like, black mold and were condemned, but they uncondemned them so we could live in them. And it was six men to a room, 12 shower heads for an entire company. The company is right around 160 people. So I think we ended up living there for 4 or 5 months, something like that. It was quite a long time. But, went home, hung out, saw all my friends. Not a lot happening. And then
it's kind of what was that like going? So you've been away for a little bit and you've actually been overseas for a little bit. You've been part of a different culture and then you come back. Was there anything really glaring when you were just like hanging out with your friends?
No, I don't. Well, this may not be the best thing to say on tape, but I think my buddy, he was going to join with me and decided not to. And then he ended up going to college and he ended up joining a fraternity. So I'd seen all the movies, Animal House and everything, you know, and I thought that fraternity kids were, like, you know, professional drinkers. I didn't realize kind of being in the Marine Corps culture and the barracks culture especially, there was just, even at that point, I guess it would have been 19. At that point, I mean, there were 25-year-old frat kids that I could basically outdrink and not even bat an eye. I mean, we just had a very strong drinking culture, and I don't know. It was kind of weird just seeing that. I guess coming back, I think it was just more mature. We were kind of used to a higher level of responsibility and, you know, just a mindset that you get in the military of having a job, doing the job. So these kids were, you know, like, I'm going to graduate. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to sit here and smoke weed and, you know, whatever. And you're like, okay. But, you know, it didn't seem like they had a lot of direction. Even my buddy who'd been in college then for like a year and a half, he didn't even know what he wanted to do after he got out of college. Like, well, I guess, you know, I usually, when I start something, I like to know, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel is kind of a motivator for me. But for them, it just seemed like they were just doing it because they could, and they didn't really have an end game.
So at this point, how far in are you into your contract?
So I guess that would have been just about 2 years, so not quite halfway done. Just about halfway done, and looking forward to getting out at that point. I recognized pretty early on that I wasn't going to be what they call a lifer, someone that stays in for, you know, for the duration and gets the pension and all that. So I was looking forward to getting out. That's why I kind of wanted to go back and see the college thing and see what these guys were doing and maybe talk that out. But then when you start talking to them, you realize they didn't really know what they were doing either. So, yeah, I was about ready. I wouldn't say I dropped my pack, you know, given up or anything like that. But I did know fairly early on definitively that I wasn't going to stay in. I mean, as long as the conflict didn't extend farther out and I could keep doing my job. After a deployment like that to Iraq in 2009, you kind of see, like, well, there isn't really a whole lot going on in Iraq. I'd never been to Afghanistan yet, so just kind of, if that's what deployments are going to be, then I don't really want to do this job the rest of my life. So
you guys are stateside then, and you're doing training exercises and things. There's actually a term. It was a DFT.
DFT, yeah, the deploy for trainings. We did, before we went to Afghan, we did Fort Bragg, AP Hill, Fort AP Hill, and then we did a bunch of stuff around Lejeune. I think at that point the Marine Corps was going through some budget cuts, so we did a lot of really cheap stuff, basically just going out and doing really, really cheap exercises that we could get done without flying to Yuma. Yuma was an extremely expensive DFT for the battalion, so just things on Lejeune, running ranges like that, you know, in front of the barracks, doing like buddy team rushes and just crap that you always hated doing because it seems so pointless, but we didn't really have the money to go, you know, like, before Iraq, we'd gone to Bridgeport. It's a mountain warfare training center as a battalion, which is like astronomically expensive. And then coming back, no one had the money to do that anymore. So everyone was kind of doing the same thing, just lower key, you know, focusing on fundamentals of small unit leadership, things like that, small unit maneuvers, because at that point, Afghanistan was ramping back up. So in 2009, so yeah, we were basically getting ready to go back to Afghanistan, where it's a different kind of warfare. It wasn't the tanks rolling into Baghdad or anything like that. A lot of it was squad PBs and just, you know, 12-man teams out there and just being really proficient at your job in that kind of setting.
So you knew Afghanistan was coming, yeah. Obviously, because you guys have been training for it. There had been a lot of talk, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so the day that you found out you're going to be deployed to Afghanistan, tell me about that.
Honestly, it was like just like Iraq. I mean, it was you're going, you're not going, you're going, you're not going. And then we finally got it. Actually, it was a little bit earlier than Iraq, but we got a date probably 8 months out. And then it changed a little bit, but it was still, you know, early December is when you're going to go, early December 2010. So we were like, okay. And we kind of started getting ready for it. And again, we went to the Mojave Viper, which this time was a little bit different because the squad that I was in, we got tasked as one squad from every company went and did a PMT. It's a police mentor team. So basically what it was is we were going to be embedded with the local police and train them rather than being sort of a part of the company as a whole. So we were specifically trained for a different job. So we didn't do the same thing we did the first Mojave Viper. We did a completely different package. Before we did that, I got sent to Pashtun language course, Pashtu, and did all that. It was like an immersion course for 8 hours a day for 6 weeks and learning all that. And then we went there, and they had guys that actually could speak Pashtu, so we spoke to them and just kind of honed our skills there, working on different ways of just basically training police while still being proficient at infantry skills. So we did a lot of different ranges. Then we got to do some cool stuff with all, they call them threat weapons, but basically the weapons that you'll see in Afghanistan being shot at you. So we got to play around with AKs and SVDs, the sniper rifles and all that kind of stuff, PKMs, RPKs. And just, it was a really, really good squad, actually. We were an extremely close-knit group just because we had, it was most of the older guys that, when 3-9 was stood up in May of 2008, and then I got there in September. So all the boots that got dropped there were from the same peer group, I guess. There was no one that, there was not really a staggered thing, like where all the guys that went to 2-3, they got there the day that 2-3 got back from Iraq. So there were senior guys that had been deployed, there were senior guys that had been to Fallujah, that had been to Nawa, all these other places. But for us, it was just, we were all basically boots, and then we all did Iraq. And then, so that specific squad that I was in was made up of those guys that I had been with for, you know, going on two and a half years now. So we were a really close-knit group. We had a couple of younger guys. We call them boots, but there were a couple of younger guys, but they were pretty good guys, and we trained them well. So we got to do a lot of cool stuff in that. And then after we came back to the company, and that was kind of different because they all kind of viewed us as outsiders, you know? So we hadn't been there the whole time. So, like, what have you guys been doing? Like, what do you care? But, you know, it's always a thing. People always find something to bitch about. So if someone's doing something else, it has to be better than what you're doing. So we came back, did that. We finished CACs out. We did the battalion effects with our company again. We got reintegrated. Then we got done with that. We went on, I think it was a three-week pre-deployment leave in November, I believe. It would have been November. So I think I just got Thanksgiving in there, and then we came back. And then we ended up deploying. I think we left for Afghanistan on December 10th.
Tell me the differences between your experience in Afghanistan and Iraq. We've already kind of figured out that Iraq was kind of boring.
Yeah.
What was Afghanistan like?
Afghanistan was also very, very boring at times. But I would say the biggest difference was actually just experiencing combat. Because we did some other stuff. We flew into Camp Dwyer, you know, messed around for a little while there, BZO'd our rifles, did all the other stuff that you do getting ready to go. And then we flew into Azadi, which is we helicoptered into Azadi, which is a very large building in southern Marja. The name of the city was Marja in Afghanistan. And started doing our RIP with 2-6. And a RIP is a relief in place of the battalion that's there. So you come in and take over their roles, what they were doing. So we got there. I think our first patrol went out on December 19th. So, yeah, 6 days after we got there, there was Christmas, and we'd already gotten shot at. So, like, wow, this kind of sucks. And then, I don't know why, but it was like raining, and I remember it was raining on Christmas. We were sitting there like really, really cold, and it was like freezing rain. And the first sergeant just walks by, is like, "Merry Christmas, motherfuckers!" And we're like, "Thanks, dude." Like, you know, he's normally an asshole anyway, so whatever. But then I think I think Afghan became real for us as sort of a life and death situation that Iraq had never really become. Because even a lot of the IEDs that went off, they didn't kill a lot of guys in Iraq at that point. I mean, what they used to like to say is that most of the good IED makers are dead by now. Most of the shitty ones are dead by now. So there's only the good ones left. But at that point, the Iraqi military was kind of stepping up their game and doing a little bit more for us. But it was on January 5th, so would have been, I guess, 16 days, something like that, after our first patrol. We had Lance Corporal Reckenthal, who is a mortarman. He stepped on IED, and he blew one of his legs off and messed up the other one pretty bad, and his arm, shrapnel all up his body kind of thing. And I think it was like that moment in particular that everyone kind of realized, like, this is going to be a lot different. It's real now. This is, you know, seeing that is a lot different than driving around in a truck and sitting there all day. And there was no, we didn't have vehicles. I mean, it was just the heel-toe express through Afghan, you know, just walking everywhere.
Because it's really mountainous, right? So you guys are having to trek up places and stuff.
Well, for us, we were in the Helmand district. So Helmand is actually really flat. The Helmand Dam was built by U.S. Army Corps of Engineer guys in the 1950s to dam the Helmand River. And the Helmand River Valley, we weren't necessarily in the valley there, but Marja in general benefited from that because they used it to irrigate the land and basically turn a desert into arable farmland where they grew poppy, which they turned into opium and other drugs and then sold for massive profits. So it was actually relatively flat for us. There was, like the biggest terrain features were what we called wadis, just huge irrigation ditches. So when we first got there, they weren't planting anything. It was winter. And then the rainy season came and they filled up with water. So you'd be crossing a wadi with your gun above your head, but up to your neck in water, and walk around for the next 8 miles soaking wet. But it was really just walking because those wadis prohibited any kind of vehicle, like transport. There were roads. They were just dirt packed roads, but it was more of a grid system because it was set up as an agricultural community much later on, something different than like a major city. So they were kind of stuck just to those roads, and they could help us out when we were close to there, but everyone in the entire battalion was just really doing foot patrols.
So you're doing lots of patrols, interacting with the locals in Afghanistan, different than Iraq, obviously.
Oh, yeah. We saw, we actually even made friends in Afghan. Like, you would go out every time you went on a patrol. If you went in a certain direction, you'd stop at the one guy's house because he's a nice dude. And, you know, he'd cook us up some lunch and stuff and that kind of thing. So nice guys there for the most part. I mean, just it was different because you lived there. I mean, you lived among them, whereas we lived on a base in Iraq. There we lived, like I said, in PBs, small, much smaller. Like the largest one would have been a company size unless you were up at Bastion, which is a battalion, but we never were. So it was a lot of smaller level stuff. So if you're just a squad leader and you're the only dude around, then the kind of head honcho of that block is going to come find you and start talking to you. And if you're just a lance corporal, I mean, he doesn't know that. So he's going to start talking to you, and just you form relationships like that. So,
so tell me about. Turn that off. Tell me about. We talked about your worst day in boot camp. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your worst day in Afghanistan.
Same thing. There were a lot of shitty days in Afghanistan, but. I think that when Reckenthal got blew up, that was probably one of the worst ones, just because after that you're kind of anesthetized to it. So it gets a little bit easier after that, not necessarily easier, but you learn how to cope with it better. But I think one of the potentially worst days that I could have is it was about 9 or 10 days after Reckenthal got blown up. My buddy McNiff, we used to call him Timmy, but his name is Tim, but we call him Timmy. Have you ever seen the show Trailer Park Boys? You know Ricky? We all had this thing, because I used to wear the BCGs, you know, the big glasses, so I was Bubbles. And then he was Ricky, because he would always just come up with some dumb shit. Like, at the one point in Afghan, we were sitting there, and we hadn't been in contact in a while, and it's like you start wanting to be in contact just to kind of break up, you know, the monotony of it all. But that's the point of the story, the monotony. So we had to go put up cami netting on a post or some shit like that. And so he gets up, stands on top of the post, and is putting the cami netting up, and the first sergeant was, you know, around somewhere for some reason. I don't know why. But he comes around, and he's like, "Hey, Marine, get off that fucking roof, you know? It's like, what if they shoot at you?" And so he's like, "Well, anything to break up the monogamy." So just the little Ricky-isms, like, from the TV show. So, so Timmy, the one day we were walking, and it was a relatively shitty day in and of itself, just because we were out patrolling all fucking day. But we heard an IED. These guys came up to us, told us to come check it out. So we went over and go check it out. It turned out some 6-year-old kid had been hit by a DFC, which is a directional force charge. It's basically a giant shotgun that they pack homemade explosives into the back of it in a canister, and they'll put anything from motorcycle spark plugs, you know, chicken wire, rocks, basically anything that'll spray out and be shrapnel. So they put one of those in a wall, and some 6-year-old had stepped on it and basically cut his body in half. So he was sitting there in a wheelbarrow. He's obviously dead. But we were putting up a cordon around it because we were going to call EOD, the explosive ordnance guys, the disposal guys, to come out and kind of check this compound, because they told us there were other IEDs in the area. So we're like, okay, well, that sucks. We probably shouldn't be here because we're not EOD. But anyway, not my call. But and the company commander was with us too, so whenever that happens, it's basically his show, and all the other shit goes out the window because, you know, he's in charge. But so we were sitting there, started getting in the cordon, and then my team was doing an overwatch farther up north of where we were at the time. So they called us back, and we're like, okay. So they had set up our squad had basically set up a triangle. So we were going to be the third edge of the triangle, basically. And they told us, go ahead and, like, you know, start going over there. So I asked the squad leader, I said, did you already sweep this area? And he said, yeah, we already swept it. It's the metal detector sweepers. And I said, okay. He said, oh, yeah, I've already swept it. I was like, okay. Cool. But I don't know. I guess I had a bad feeling, or I just kind of wanted to do it anyway. So this guy, Timmy, he was my sweeper. So he pulled out the sweeper, and, like, as he went to take a step, an IED went off. And so I was, like, from me to you, for the people listening, it's probably about 5 feet of separation. And, like, his back was to me, but I was 5 feet away. And then our corpsman, because we had all come in to meet the squad leader as he was sitting there. Corpsman was probably 8 feet behind that, my buddy Ray. But so the IED goes off. Only thing I remember is just, you know, dust everywhere, a little spinning battery pack in the air. And I'm thinking to myself, like, just a stupid moment, like, oh, shit, they got us. Because, like, in CACs, you know, they would blow up fake IEDs, and it would just be dust. And you're like, oh, fuck, they got us, you know, bullshit. And then after probably what felt like 10 seconds was probably more like half a millisecond, you realize, like, no, we're actually in Afghanistan, and that's a real fucking IED. So like I said, this was 10 days after our other buddy had got blown up, and then I didn't know the Reckonthal guy as well as I knew this guy. Like I said, we got dropped together, and we'd been pretty good friends for a long time. So I remember I got thrown backwards on my back, and I saw him go forward. And I ran up, and I jumped over the little crater where the IED had been. I came up to him, and he's fucking just screaming his head off. And I looked down, and everything's okay. No blood, legs were all there, everything. And I'm like checking him. And he's just fucking, you know, freaking out. So I smacked him in the face a little bit. I said, hey, man, chill out. Your legs are still there. You're good. There's no blood. You know, I'm like doing the sweeps and shit down the leg to check if any blood seeps through, you know. And it just, there wasn't any. What ended up happening, it was during the rainy season, and it was a 15-pound IED, which was the same one that went off on the other guy. But somehow the HME inside the little oil buckets that they used had gotten wet. So it was, most of the explosives were inert, and it ended up only like 2 pounds of a 15-pound IED went off. So basically his leg got popped up, he kneed himself in the face and fell down. And like I said, the company commander was there, so they're just standing there like fucking, holy shit, just staring at it, like not reacting like officers should probably react in this situation. But the company commander comes over and he says, McNiff, are you all right? And so I love him for this, the day I die, but McNiff pulls out a 7-star and puts it in his mouth. He's like, no, I'm not fucking all right. I just got blown up by an IED. As he's sitting there lighting his cigarette, you know. But that was probably potentially one of the worst days. And then they told us we had to go, we were supposed to go back to Dwyer and get checked for, I guess, traumatic brain injuries. But basically, we finished the patrol and then went into the corpsman's office. And they had us take, like, a little test to see if we had a concussion or anything. But it wasn't necessarily a pass-fail kind of thing. It was like a, no, I really don't want to go anywhere kind of thing. So, yeah, that would have been one of the worst days. But then he ended up, actually, my buddy McNiff, he came back, like, 2 weeks later, finished the whole deployment with us. So that was actually, I guess, one of the better days from what it could have been. But
so you're coming to the end of your deployment, mm-hmm. and you're getting ready to come home. Mm-hmm. Were you ready to come home?
I don't know. It's a weird mentality, and I mean, I don't know. People listen to this, and they might not get it unless they've been there. I think there's a reason why they keep Marine deployments to 7 months instead of a year for the Army, because especially towards the end of our deployment, we just got a really morbid sense of humor and just of life in general. So just at the beginning of the deployment, you know, you sweep everything, you're going through and everything's an IED, you know, and you're like sharp and you're on point shit. By 6.5 months in, if you think it's an IED, there's people just like stomping on the ground and saying, nope, I guess it's not. And like, that's a pretty common thing that I've heard the story from a lot of Marines before. It's just kind of like you lose the sharpness a little bit, I guess. You kind of get that not really giving a fuck attitude. For me personally, it was one time I was out. I mentioned my buddy Ray. He was our corpsman. It's a Navy corpsman. He's like our version of a medic. But we were walking the one day, and we decided to take a security haul because I can't even remember why. But I ended up just – I carried a Mark 32, which is a 6-shot grenade launcher. It's stupid heavy. So I usually sat down as much as possible. But you know, they're always like, no, never stand down because, you know, you're, or sit down because there's more surface area on the ground and less chance of hitting an ID. Mathematically, so like, shut up, dude, I'm just going to sit down. So I remember the one time we sat there and came up to a little berm and walking back after a relatively short patrol, actually. I remember just flopping down, kind of sitting on this berm, and we heard like a, it's a weird sound to describe, it was like a snap and a hiss kind of thing. And it wasn't, when a bullet passes really close to you, it makes a snap. But it wasn't that. It was like a really small noise, like snips, something like that. And so my friend Ray, who was always, I think a lot of corpsmen are, but he was always like just really scared of IEDs and just always looking around, you know, like he never got to that point where he would step on something, you know. He'd always be like, you stupid fucking idiots are crazy. But we heard that the one day, and we never knew if it did because I never checked it. I didn't care at that point. But like I said, this is about 6.5 months in. So he's like, you know, gets all his like freak out face on. He's like, what the fuck was that, man? I was like, I don't know, probably a blasting cap. Just sat there. Like, it didn't go off. So, I mean, and I had no desire to get up whatsoever. So it's like, fuck it. If it didn't go off already, it's not going off. So we ended up just sitting there, and then they called it. We got up fucking and left. I mean, looking back, there's people that, you know, listen to this and be like, well, you should have fucking dug it up because then they could have reused the HM. It's like, yeah, but like I said, the mentality that you get into at that point, you just don't care anymore. So, yeah, coming home was, I don't even know if it was necessarily coming home. It was just not being there anymore. I don't know. There are times, like, after you got back where you just wanted to be back there because it was just such a simple lifestyle, you know. You go, you do your job, and there's not car payments, there's not cell phone payments, there's not talking to your girlfriend or your wife, you know, and that's, you call them on the phone and shit. But it's just a really simple, like, no nonsense way of life. You have a job, you do it every day, and if you're good at it, you know, you're still alive. So that's a reward. Every day is a reward in and of itself, as long as you're doing your job. So I don't think there's a whole lot of, well, the majority of jobs aren't like that, where if you're doing your job right, then you can say that I'm alive and that's my reward, you know. I mean, there are dangerous jobs in the civilian world, obviously, but I think it became a little bit more real for us after seeing other guys. But, yeah, definitely ready to get home. So when it was time to go home, we ripped with 3-6, who had been there before 2-6, so this was their second time in Marja. And it pretty much just went as smoothly as smooth as you could hope for, except for that they ripped with us in, I guess it would have been June. So June in Marja is very, very hot. And I mean, it's just summer. And so they came there and they had a lot of guys that were in relatively good shape. But I remember for some reason for them, they got there in July or June, and we didn't think anything of it because we'd been doing it, you know, the whole time. But we had a lot of their guys dropping as heat cases, just getting heat casualties, coming up being so hot, but we didn't even recognize it anymore. I mean, when I went to Afghan, I was 185 pounds, and I came back as 159, just sweating constantly. And I mean, I didn't have anything to lose either. It's not like I was chunky or anything. I was like muscle, but just, you lost all that weight because you're just constantly sweating and walking around with, you know, almost 100 pounds of shit on just almost every day. But so we saw that, and we wished them good luck, basically, because they seemed like they knew what they were doing for the most part. I mean, I never talk shit about another battalion. Everyone has their own way of doing things. But, yeah, they took over for us. We got back on the planes, flew back to Dwyer. And then after that, flew back to Kyrgyzstan, Manus Air Base. And then after that, flew back to Shannon, Ireland again. I guess came full circle from the Iraq deployment. So flew back into Shannon. Weren't allowed to drink. Well, we weren't allowed to drink in Manus, which I know I talk a lot about drinking, but we really wanted to after Afghanistan. But when we got to Manus, they told us we couldn't, you know. There's the old wives' tales that of why Marines can't drink, mostly just because we're drunken assholes. But the story went that in Manus, some Air Force female officer had gotten on a Marine sergeant's case or a staff sergeant, something like that, for not saluting her or something when they were at the bar. So he Spartan kicked her over a table or something like that. Probably a bullshit story, maybe a small kernel of truth in there. I mean, it could have been a Lance Corporal and, you know, like an E3 in the Air Force, and they got in a fist fight, but these things get blown up. But anyways,
let's skip ahead a little bit and tell me about readjusting. Did you was was it difficult? Was it easy? Was it just like you walked right back into your old life, or was there definitely perspective differences? And
yeah, I think that's like the story I was just talking about that has a little bit of bearing on it, because it's even after going through all that and, you know, finally seeing combat and being the Marine that you thought you were going to be when you joined, they still treated you kind of, you treated everybody like a kid, you know, like you can't be trusted to do these things. You can't be trusted to do that. So you get back and it's like, well, you get some boot officer that's never been to combat coming into you, like, well, fill out your ROE or not your ROE, your risk mitigation plan for, you know, your leave. Like, I just got back from fucking Afghanistan, man. I think I know how to mitigate my own risks when I drive off base and go get a burger at Texas Roadhouse. But I think that actually right when I got back, that's when it was like nails in the coffin of I'm done, I'm out, because I'm sick of getting treated like a piece of shit and not an adult. So it wasn't universal, but for me getting back personally, I know that I did go through some shit just readjusting, but it didn't feel like that. It just kind of felt like I was doing my everyday thing. And then looking at the person I was then and the person I am now, I know that it's been a slow transition, kind of becoming more of what you would call a normal person, you know, perhaps not a fifth of whiskey a night and two packs of cigarettes a day person, whereas now I don't smoke and, you know, I'll go to the brewery to have a beer every now and again. But my wife's been extremely helpful in that. Just, she was always there. We dated all through Afghanistan and stuff. So she's just been, I think those interpersonal relationships, you kind of get, you have to get used to having them again, because when you spend so much of your life just relying on another person based on the fact that you couldn't go to combat together, and then you have to form a relationship with another person based on the fact that you're married and you have kids, you know, and it's a different, qualitatively, it's a different relationship, you know. You can't expect them to understand that, but then at the same time, they shouldn't have to. A lot of people, that's why they join, you know, so that they don't, their wives and kids don't have to see the shit that they saw. So I think for me, definitely, I've gotten a lot better, you know. It's having those friends around. Like I said, I talk to my one friend, you know, almost every day now, and we went through all the same shit, and just talking to other veterans, taking it easy, you know, getting back into school, getting back into just kind of, like I said, what you consider a normal routine, you know, just a little bit older than the other kids, a little bit different life experiences, but still here trying to get a degree, trying to get a job, take care of my family. So not some like anomaly of a student, you know, that, you know, there was the one lady recently, a Montana public official, that said like all soldiers have PTSD. And I was like, well, that's bullshit. Not all soldiers have PTSD. I mean, it's just some people need longer time to work stuff out, and some people need a shorter time. For me, I think it was relatively short. I just kind of, I wanted to get back into a swing of things. I wanted to get my life going again and take that, what I did in the military, as a chapter and not necessarily the whole book, which some guys do. You know, it's, that's it. That's their entire life is about that one section. For me, it's just, like I said, it's a chapter in a book, and then I'll use the skills I learned there and the lessons that I learned and move on with my life and apply them, because I think they're useful. So,
do you think, and this will be the last question, but do you think if you, knowing what you know now, went back to when you were younger, mm-hmm. getting right out of high school, making that decision, would you make the same decision today? Are you glad that you did it, or are you resentful? You know?
Yeah, absolutely, I would do it again. I mean, if I actually had that opportunity, it's easy to say, but if it is actually sitting in front of me, if I woke up, you know, 17 and a half years old and I could back out at any moment, I'd have to think about it a little bit. But I think definitely I would. I mean, I wouldn't be the person I am today without that experience. And I don't even know if I would like the person I'd be if I didn't do it. So I know myself pretty well, and I recognize the path that I was on. It wasn't anything respectable. So yeah, I would definitely do it again. I think the best way to say it is that I owe it to myself, just knowing that I did do it. It's a huge pillar in my life. Like I said, it's not how I define myself, but it's where I learned to be a man, basically. So I would do it again. I would still be infantry. I would still go over there, do all the things that I had done. So I don't have any regrets about it.
Thank you for sharing. It was really good talking to you too.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Thank you.